is Melinda Pillsbury Foster. Reclaim America now. Reclaim your consciousness now. Reclaim your heritage, your spiritual heritage now. And we are here on RMN, on the Micro Effect, and we are having a wonderful discussion with Stella and Brian about the nature of consciousness, where this evolution is taking us, how we're getting there, and all the questions in between. And when we had to take off for our break, Stella was talking to us about her personal experience. Her experience and Brian's has led them to a common place, which is music, the vibration of music that permeates our cells, our bodies, and our consciousness, and helps us actually alter our state so that we, in many senses, expand, so that we can touch each other more closely. Stella, could we get into that again?
Sure, Melinda. Well, I guess, you know, for me, I could give you a little bit about my background and my particular journey and where that's taken me. So really from the age of 4 and 5, I used to lock myself in my parents' bathroom and start making all sorts of weird noises, which used to drive my mother out then, really. And I was basically working with the sound. And because it was tiled, I was able to feel resonance, like I'd hit a middle C. And all the walls would start to shake, and I'd be like, wow, this is just the most amazing thing. So I used to go in and make all these sorts of weird noises, my poor mother. And then later on I realized that what I was doing was I was kind of expanding the sound bubble that was coming out of my mouth, and it was actually resonating against the walls. So the walls weren't moving, but the illusion was that they were moving. And so that kind of took me into a very interesting space where I wanted to see if I could do that with light. And so what I did it was I started to paint with my voice, and I could actually see the colors that were coming out of my mouth. I was able to see all sorts of weird and wonderful colors that you wouldn't necessarily see on the spectral Pantone here on Earth of color. And so most notes and musical tones have a certain color for me. And then I, as a teenager, I got very much into painting, and you know, by the age of the age of 12, I was painting whole complete chakra system of the human body, and you know, working with the energy centers of the body. So I would sing into the energy centers, and colors would appear that very much, you know, correlate to what we see in the chakra system of, you know, red spectralizing all the way up to purple through all the different chakras. And that, you know, that was something I wasn't exposed to as a child. I wasn't exposed to any of the chakra or the Vedic teachings or any of that kind of stuff, which, of course, I later on studied and looked into. So it was almost like I was receiving information through this light and sound. And then, really, by the time I was about 16 or 17, I wanted to record my first pop song, which was hilarious. And I had so much fun doing that. I went to a studio with friends, and I suddenly realized that I had a tone in my voice from their feedback that was, you know, was something quite unusual. And then I ended up going and singing jazz for about 20 years after that, because I absolutely grew up in jazz and loved it. And so I went for an audition to the Ritz Hotel in London, the 21-piece jazz orchestra, and I went along at 19, sort of teetering along with a little ponytail, and all these jazz impresarios sitting in this room, all in their 70s, and I was quite daunted, really, by the whole thing. And I opened my mouth and sang, and they said, "You've got the job, you know, you've got the job." So I was resident vocalist there for about 2 years. But there was always an underpinning spiritual quest, like getting to the meaning of what spirit is about. And so I read lots of books, and I went on lots of workshops. I was your sort of archetypal workshop junkie, you know, going around trying to find myself everywhere else, but looking inside me, you know, which of course is how we get to find out who we are. We go within. But I was looking outside me for such a long time, and it was very much my process that I had to go through, you know, looking out, reaching out to others and getting the reflections that I needed to find out who I was. And then working in my later years, taking people to Egypt, doing workshops myself, sharing my life experiences, working with sound. And then one day I was in a very, very deep meditation, and I was in probably gone for about 4 or 5 hours. And I came out of the meditation, and the two words that were given to me in that long period of time of silence were music frequency. So I quickly came back to Earth, if you like, and put into Google music frequency. And the first website I came to was Brian's, omega432.com.
Wow. So that's how you met.
That was amazing, because I totally read all the stuff in there, completely resonated with everything that I was reading. It was like, yep, you know, this is absolutely true. I feel all of this information is true. And when I heard the difference on his website, and Brian's playing Silent Night in 432 hertz and 440 hertz, I just felt the difference between music in the head and music in the heart. And music in the head was 440 hertz, which is our concert pitch today, and 432 I could feel with my whole being, absolutely. And then about a year later, Brian and I ended up being admins together, unbeknown to each other, on a Facebook group, a 432 Facebook group. And then we kind of connected and we decided to work together and make some music together. And that's how we've been working together ever since.
That's a beautiful story. I mean, you can see just how the resonance has brought you together.
Yeah. And we're making lots of music and we're doing all sorts of projects together. And it's really exciting.
And it's very easy as well. And that's another thing is when you're in that space of co-creating in the heart, it's just things, they just appear to you. And this is the whole thing, is there's a lack of want or need of any of the lower frequencies, such as greed or ambition or fear or mistrust or any of those kind of things. So it really is something, and I'm so thankful that Stella and I have gotten together, and I'm looking forward to, you know, creating as much as we can, and giving that out to all the listeners and, you know, all the great folks of the earth.
And it's listening to your music, because certainly I've done that on quite a number of occasions now, is an amazing experience, because you can just feel it going through you. It just provides a wonderful sense of relaxation and heightened awareness.
It's interesting because one of my earlier memories is before I could talk, being a very, very young baby in a baby carriage, and looking up and listening to the raindrops hitting the top of the baby carriage. I used to lie there and make all kinds of rhythms and music in my essence and in my mind. So I was introduced to that very early on, and then I would hear an alarm clock that my parents had, and it used to be one of those old wind up things, and it used to do this and all this weird, and it would do all the syncopated rhythms over time. And I would spend hours rather than toys. I had no interest in toys. I had interest in the world around me and all the gamut of the beautiful frequencies that nature had. I used to go out and, like I say, is listening to the wind going through the leaves and the trees was an absolute masterpiece symphony. And listening to the sound of rushing water was a cacophony of the greatest works of man, of all art, rushing by. So these were all the things that kind of inspired me. And just naturally, I went from my folks, we went to Canada in 1980. And that was a change for me from Scotland. And right away I got into music, and I started playing bass. And bass was the love of my life. And I continued writing right away. I was already, I didn't take any lessons, until my sister had bought me a bass guitar for one birthday, and it came with three lessons. And on the second lesson, the teacher went to my sister, no, I can't have this guy, he's teaching me stuff. And so I just kind of had that natural ability, you know, of already innately being able to connect through music. And right from when I was a child all the way up, my way of communicating was not mainly verbal, it was musical. And so that's how I could express myself. And like Stella, I was able to kind of not so much see, but I could hear color. So I could actually hear the color of chords and be able to pick out all kinds of really hard to hear melodies and chords within an entire whole symphonic structure. And that's what actually got me a lot of gigs when I was younger, was the ability to be able to come in as a session player and step into a role and fill shoes in a very fast time, in a turnaround to play music. And so I kind of, you know, built my career first early on in my 20s of doing that, as being basically a hired gun that would go on tour for artists and then be in the studio and you know, play behind the scenes, you know, kind of musician's musician. Not really out in the public, but, you know, supporting a lot of artists and doing the back-end production. And that's how I got my kind of production hat, was in bigger studios in Canada, you know, just being able to, you know, do that back-end thing. And then it's quite interesting, because it got to a point for me where, even though I was so immersed in music, there was something completely hollow about it, and I couldn't place my finger on it. And it was around 24 years ago when, because what had ended up happening was, I played in a stadium one night, and I was warming up in rehearsal, and I played an E7 sharp 9 chord, which is a kind of a jazzy chord, and it sounded like the entire whole roof, iron roof of the stadium, was going to collapse. And I was like, "Whoa, what's that?" I altered the chord to take the sharp 9 out of it, and it was fine. So that night performance, I had to remember not to play that chord. And that got me on the travels of resonance and frequency. Mm-hmm. And then when I was visiting over some standing stones in Scotland, something really changed in me, because like that, where I could hear the color, all of a sudden I could see that color for the first time in the form of an hyperdimensional field that was coming out of standing stones. And right then and there is that's what got me into studying into geometry. And from there, I found an immediate connection to 432 and the ancient world. And then that was it. I was sold. I'm like, wow, it's like a sponge to water. I couldn't learn enough. I would, rather than having a social life, I was always studying as much as I could. And you know, that brought through the future up until, you know, basically now is after learning about 432 24 years ago, I decided to make a switch in 2001 to piano from bass. And I picked it up instantly. And just shortly after that, I decided, even though I was still playing gigs in 440, I decided, okay, I need to walk the walk. And so that's what I did. I ended up saying to myself, right, that's it. I'm going to make a go of 432. And I've never looked back since. And it's been such a joyous occasion. And now, because we're not the only ones who's known about this, Graham Jackson in Canada has been promoting 432 for over 40 years. There's some guys out in Italy and Spain and all over. And so it's all a journey of rediscovery of what these ancient connections is to nature, and that there are absolute prime number mathematics. And it just makes sense that if it's all around you and we use it, that we use it for our music.
Mm-hmm. And what have you noticed about it when people listen to the music? Because you have been, you know, making music for a long time now. You've been recording it. And I know that there is an impact when people listen to your music. I felt it, of course, myself. But tell us about that. What's it like when you see people listening to your music and you can see these changes taking place in them?
Well, for myself, playing in that frequency, it's one where when you're the artist, there's always a deep connection with the audience, but it's actually an unseen connection because you're usually up on a stage and there's lights bearing down on you. And trust me, when you've got, sometimes if you're on a main stage with 75,000 watts worth of lights, you can't see a thing in front of you. It's just blackness. But you can feel the presence. Now, what's interesting, although I've been in situations of playing 432 in live performance, it's not until I've actually been in the audience watching another band play it in 432 that the impact was so profound. Last year, I saw a band, Brand, in Toronto, and they had came across the 432 through the website and other means. And we're watching, and what was amazing was the response of the audience. I was more interested in what the audience were doing because there was a general overall well-being feeling. I'm not going to make the claim that, you know, it's one frequency is love, but there's certainly a carrier wave into the heart, and that is very, very evident. You see the behavior and the body language of an entire audience as opposed to, say, at 440, which it's been clocked as, you know, usually creating antisocial conditions. Now, what was interesting was that during the break, when the band took a break, the music that came over the tannoy, the PA, was in 440. And instantly, you saw the disconnection chatter where everybody goes off into one or two conversations, and the entire ambient noise level was one of chaos. So that was a very interesting observation. And for all the listeners out there, is check it out for yourself. Go and check that out. But also do other experiments, such as like take water and charge water with 432 hertz frequency, feed it to your plants, feed it another frequency, and just check out what happens. You know, I urge everybody to participate in the experience for themselves and share feedback. That's the wonderful thing about being able to connect.
Mm-hmm. And tell us specifically what you saw. What was the difference in people's behavior? Give us some visuals here, okay?
Well, I actually saw a lot of couples being intimate, and I'm not talking in a innate sexual way. I'm talking in an absolute connected, loving way. And that's something that I think is missing in a lot of performances, because usually the intent of the music is very angry in a lot of senses, because the power of intention is extremely powerful. But it seems that in 432, regardless of the genre, because I was listening to a hard rock band, and mm-hmm. this was having this loving effect. And it was very soothing. Well,
that's so interesting that would be the case. And I know that you are a real master at music. Both of you are. When did the 440, you said? When did that become sort of dominant?
Well, you have to realize that there's been a kind of a debate or thing going on about frequency for a very, very long time. Through Europe, there was a culling of certain frequencies through spiritual bells that happened during the time of Henry VIII. And from then onwards, there was great debates on what tuning or central tuning orchestras should be. I mean, it's jumped all over the place from 420, 451, all over the map throughout Europe. And Mozart, for an example, and Verdi, it's been mentioned by the Schiller Institute that they specifically wrote for 432. In Paris, they tried to bring it in convention at 435. In terms of 440, there was a concerted effort to raise concert pitch under the Alexander, which was the Tsar of Russia, who attended the Conference of Vienna in 1815. And it was mentioned at that conference to try and juxtapose a higher concert pitch throughout Europe. So the standards were kind of flying all over the map. In terms of an actual, what ended up happening in America was after 1917, J.C. Deacon, who came in and attended a lecture of Heinrich Holtz, which is famous for writing a book of the psychological sensations on tone. And what he did was influence the American Federation in the 1920s to adopt 440 as a standard. So we kind of had it in the States from then on, and around the world there was a concerted petition in France to not adopt 440 but going into lower pitch. But that was actually overlooked in legal kind of proceedings in October 3rd, 1953, the ISO quietly passed it as a arbitrary standard.
So there's a long history here, and you started to uncover this history that must have certainly directed your own research, right?
I think what ends up happening is when you do research, it's coming from the mind because you want proof. And then what ends up happening is you spend months, years, decades coming full circle to what your heart already knew in the first place, which is why your instinct is usually always right. So for me, it's like, don't! I had to do 24 years worth of research to get back to my heart.
Right. So what your heart told you, what you knew was true, you had to go validate it. And then after you'd validated it, you accepted it.
Well,
would that be accurate?
But what that did was teach me one thing, was that the heart is the true validation. And in that space, when you are there, you already have the answers because you truly use what frequencies you feel is right for yourself. And specifically for myself, 432 was correct. And for a lot of other people, especially musicians, who, for example, singers who are having difficulty with the higher concert pitches, 440, 444, 449, 51 and such, they're having difficulty with their physical, with their vocal cords being stretched beyond the ability of what human experience of singing is all about. So that's why a lot of singers are also choosing 432.
So everything is telling them, all indications are telling them that this is where they need to go, and this is, what really works in music. This is the appropriate resonance, right?
It's an appropriate resonance where we all need to come together in order to have a centralized pitch in order to make consonant or beautiful music. Now, in terms of healing, we all know that know thyself or heal thyself. We are already generating an infinite amount of frequency. There's nothing that your power of intention cannot do. And in that is specifically, we are all born unique onto this planet with certain alchemies of the planets and where they were. So you're actually your own tuning fork, your own pitch and whatnot. And the best way to actually get in tune with that is just go out for a walk in nature, splash in the water, and listen to the leaves and the trees. And that is far more powerful. However, if we have to get along to play music together, I suggest that 432 hertz as a concert pitch is more a natural way to go.
If I may add to that too, Brian and Melinda, it's really interesting when we look at the ancient ways, you know, the high priests and the people who were, you know, if you like, closest to God, were the healers and musicians of their time. And when we look at what's happened to society today, you know, musicians are struggling because their music is being distributed all over the internet for free. They're not getting compensated for the efforts of creativity that they're releasing. And I'm very much a believer in open source, and I think that's something when we can all get it together that really does work. But then you look at healers and the sort of implant that runs through society that, they, you know, if you're a proper healer, you should never be paid. And, you know, it's about turning that around. It's looking at we're all healers, we're all musicians, we can all sing, we're all born with a human voice. We all have the ability to make sound. And whether that person believes they can sing or not, they can. Everybody has a tone. Everybody has a resonance that is individually theirs in this very, you know, combined collective orchestra of this universe. And when we look at architecture, I think it was Goethe that once said that all architecture is just crystallized music. So when we look at, you know, we wanted to break out the 432, even for people I know that don't feel they can sing, when they start humming and chanting and toning along with the tuning forks, the 432 hertz forks, you know, they're getting into a space where they find their inner voice, and their inner voice is allowed to come out. So I just think it's a really interesting observation to look at the ancient healing technologies that we had with sound and healing, and how that's totally been destroyed in modern society.
That's a wonderful observation, and that's a beautiful visual to think about, you know, the concert of the world. I think we're probably coming to the close of this this section, but let's hold that in our minds and get into applying that sort of to the rise of consciousness, because didn't you just sort of very profoundly enunciate what that is? It's all of us coming together in concert.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a harmonious state again in that, but also there's something very interesting is that there is correlation between that tuning and what's going on with the natural spiral orbits, and as such, at the precession of the equinox has been well known, well documented in stone, and I've been researching that for quite some time.
Absolutely.
And there is a kind of an origin pattern that's raising consciousness. It's not so much that it's a misnomer of ascending. You don't need to ascend out. You're trying to get back in to experience our human condition.
Absolutely.
Usually higher frequencies knock you out. But the raising of consciousness is different than the ascension.
Let's just hold it till we get to the other side. This is going to be fascinating. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster, Reclaim America Now, here on RMN on the Micro Effect. The consciousness is rising. Listen to our advertisers, vote on TalkStream Live, and we will be back with you on the other side of the moment.
We hope you enjoyed this free excerpt from today's program. Register to become a sponsoring member so you can hear the complete interview for any of the radio shows in our library. Just click the sidebar link and select your membership level. It's that easy.